D-Mace, Vingen and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Derek Mason, Adam Vingen here with you. Let's go to our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com, and welcome in our friend David Ubben of The Athletic, as well as the Bunch Formation podcast. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Of course. Thank you for joining us. So, David, Nick Saban played a role in the hiring of the Predators' new GM, but he couldn't be at the news conference yesterday because he was testifying in front of Congress in support of the Protect College Sports Act. What stood out to you about Saban's testimony yesterday?
I think you could call it self-serving. I think, you know, a lot of the things that they say are accurate, but if you sort of zoom out and revisit what they're not saying, you know, when coach pay was exploding in the last 20 years, I didn't hear a lot of talk about limits and bankrupting athletic departments and all of these things. So, you know, Bobby Bowden was the first million-dollar coach, what was it, like 2000, something like that, and we're sitting here 20, 25 years later, and there's, you know, a handful of guys making $10 million or more. So, you know, it is what it is. I think when you look at, hey, you can point to the exponential growth of the cost of rosters, but I think that you're forgetting that you added $20 million of rev share into that. Some of that is leveling off. So I think the idea that, like, oh, we're going to be having $100 million rosters in, like, 2 years, I'm not sure I buy that, because it's a little bit like the idea of pooling media rights, and you say, well, we make $4 billion now, we're going to make $8 billion. It's like, well, where's that other $4 billion coming from? Because the TV networks aren't exactly rolling in cash either. Like, at some point, the bubble pops. So, you know, I think there's some convenient truths being told and some inconvenient truths being omitted when you talk about pushing this bill and what the economics of an athletic department look like in 2025.
David, what do you make of Saban being one of the key messengers in all of this? I've seen a lot of accusations of Saban being a hypocrite. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose you could say that. Like I said, I think nobody seems to have an issue when coach pay was exploding and was costing places a lot. You have places like Texas A&M paying a $70 million for a guy not to coach. Nobody seems to, you know, be looking for a Congress or a congressional bailout from that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it is what it is. But I think ultimately, like, he's a guy that has time and has a lot of cachet and people know who he is and he's well respected in the sport. So I think, like, you know, that's sort of where it is. And obviously he cares about the sport. But again, I think you have people with power speaking to other people with power, trying to impose rules on people who don't have a lot of power. And that, I think, rubs me a little bit the wrong way.
Saban acknowledged at the hearing that adjustments will need to be made to this bill, which at the moment would allow the NCAA to limit transfers and eligibility and enforce a spending cap, among other things. Which elements of the Protect College Sports Act do you think are the likeliest to receive support from all parties?
The one-time transfer is complicated. I think the 5-for-5, I think people are tired of the waivers, tired of, you know, we've seen, like, guys that get drafted in the NBA coming back to college basketball. I think that was a step too far for the public consciousness. So I think 5-for-5 eligibility is a slam dunk. But, like, ultimately, I don't think the Big Ten and the SEC are real interested in taking the idea of a super league off the table, which is sort of part of this. It's like, well, I think they'd like more control over what the future of their enterprise looks like. So eligibility is the only thing that I think makes a ton of sense. The one-time transfer rule would receive a lot of support from people that are in administration and in coaching. But I think you'd have politicians looking around saying, okay, I get why people want this, but why is this fair? So I think that to me stands out about this particular bill.
David Ubben of The Athletic is with us. David, last week, I think it was last week, you were at SEC spring meetings. What was the most fascinating or absurd thing you overheard or saw during your time at the meetings?
I mean, I think just hearing how angry the SEC's coaches are about the Big 12 and about how the committee and the metrics operate, you know, they want a lot of assurances from the committee that, hey, we're taking on this ninth conference game. We want that to be reflected in the rankings and in the metrics. And asking the college football playoff, like, what do your metrics like? Both as a legitimate football strategy thing, like, do we need to be balanced run and pass, and a non-conference scheduling thing, like, what is too far or what is not far enough in scheduling? And it's an inexact science. On the one hand, the metrics aren't forward projecting, and two, the metrics are only a tool, and they are a big part of how the committee operates, but it's the opinions of 13 people, and, you know, a quarter of those are going to be rolling off and we'll be having new people in the committee next year. So, you know, the playoff wasn't there to argue, but I think, like, there's an element of what do you want me, like, they can't offer you, you know, exactly what's going to happen or how the metrics are going to reflect on one team or another projecting forward. And that just sort of enraged the coaches and athletic directors in the room.
Now, David, in this act that the Congress is putting toward the floor, say if it doesn't get passed, because this may be the only bipartisan thing that is going on in politics right now, so that's a plus. But let's say if it doesn't pass, how long would it be before the SEC and the Big Ten start to make plans on moving to that super conference? Because it seems like they're not in agreement, and a part of it, like you said, could be because it completely takes away their ability to sort of detach from everybody else.
Well, so, I mean, I'm just really skeptical that this mm-hmm. bill is going to get very far at all. You only have really a few weeks here where you can make this happen because you're going to go on summer recess. And then when you come back in the fall, you're going to have a lot of Congress focusing on re-election, like it's midterm season. That's just the reality of where we're at and how Congress works. So, like, you got kind of one shot to kind of rush this, and I don't think that it's that close to happening and getting the kind of support they need to pass. So as far as what that looks like in the future, you know, I've talked to some commissioners of other leagues, and they kind of laugh when they hear about the Super League concept, because you talk about, you know, creating this thing, and they're like, the Big Ten and the SEC can't even agree with how to run a postseason. How are they going to make a league that makes a lot of sense? And so, yeah, it sounds good in theory, but you get in the nitty-gritty of how to do it when you have leagues that see the world very differently. You know, like I said, for 2 years in a row now, have been engaged in a stalemate on the future of the college football playoff. Last year, you know, the Big Ten was pushing for 16 with automatic qualifiers and got almost no support, and the SEC did not want that. Now, the Big Ten pushing for 24, the SEC probably prefers a little bit closer to 16 with no AQs, and they're not going anywhere. So it's messy, to say the least. But, you know, I think the sport is trending in that Super League direction, but getting there has about a million hurdles that they're going to have to figure out a way to get over.
Now, Saban did mention that, you know, if the model continues to go the way that it's going, that it's going to ultimately become professional sports or mini NFL. I tend to believe that we are closer to it being there now than anything. So this is something that they should have tried to stop long ago, but they didn't. But how long do you think it's going to get to a point where athletes now will need to have representation, meaning a union? Because if you're trying to add all these other things in, you're trying to put a cap on how much each school can get, which is fair, and I think you need to do it. But even with that, there's going to have to be some type of increase in that cap, whether it be every year or every other year, a percentage or two, just like the NFL, in order to continue mm-hmm. to go out and get these guys. So what I'm saying is that, do you think it ever becomes a moment where it's players with their union versus, you know, the NCAA?
So the players, as they're putting together these rules, if you don't get an antitrust exemption from Congress, which, again, for the reasons we talked about, I'm not sure that mm-hmm. that's coming. Especially when you have midterm elections and likely gridlock in the House and Senate. We'll see what the presidential election, like, this stuff affects college sports and its future. So, but they're going to have some sort of representation, barring a antitrust exemption. What that looks like, I think, is complicated. I've talked to, you know, there's sort of three different groups that are sort of pushing to be something close to a players' union. And I talked to them, like, well, does the transient nature of your workforce not become an issue? And they seem to say no. They seem to believe it's not. I think it serves them to believe that it's not. I don't see how that's not an issue, because in the NFL, you've got guys that are going to be stalwarts in the league for a decade. Mm-hmm. College football, a kid's a freshman. He's just trying to figure it out. Maybe a sophomore is interested in engaging this. By your third year, you're talking about 1 year, and if you're good enough, you're probably going to the pros. So, like, at best, you have people that would be in a leadership position for two-something years. The idea that I have pitched that I think could work is having something close to – now, the Student Athlete Advisory Council, mm-hmm. you know, is sort of a puppet organization, I think, in general, to say the things that they want them to say in these sort of congressional or hearings, that kind of stuff. But if you had a player-backed version of that, something along those lines, where it's a group of 10 people like that or something like that that can represent the players and their interests in these groups, and when you put language into a letter of intent that says, hey, I agree to be represented by these groups, I think you could sort of backdoor your way into not really an official union, but something where you're making these rules and the players and their the players are being represented in the rules as they're being made, so that when these rules are enforced, you can't just run to a court and lack the ability to enforce them like we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years. I think you're still a long way from getting close to that. I think there's still going to be some efforts to make something close to a players' union. But, you know, just it's a math problem, okay? I mentioned the transient nature, but in the NFL, you got 32 teams of 53 guys on an active roster and then a bunch of practice squad guys. That's what, we'll be generous and say 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. In college football, especially just in the FBS level, you got 138 teams. You got 105 guys on that roster. We're talking about 10,000, if my math serves me correctly. That's five times as large. And there's also what Akron players and what Louisiana players want is going to be different from what Ohio State players want. Mm-hmm. What Alabama, versus the NFL, generally everyone's interests are aligned at the players' level. So it's just way more complicated. And so I don't envy the people trying to find solutions and get to a common sense place that's sustainable. But, I mean, just in this conversation, you can see, like, getting there is incredibly difficult and complex. And the sport as a whole lacks the apparatuses to make it happen.
David, you were at Lane Kiffin's return to Knoxville, no?
I was not, actually. I was watching that game on my phone at a McDonald's in the middle of Georgia because I elected to go to Kentucky, Georgia that game instead.
The reason I asked was I was going to ask you how you think Lane Kiffin's return to Ole Miss this season is going to be by comparison.
Well, so the Lane Kiffin thing, like, that was exacerbated by the questionable officiating and, like, some of those other calls. And, like, it was already going to be simmering, and I think some of the officiating pushed it over into boiling and you know, provided the scene that we saw. The Ole Miss thing, it's going to be significantly more intense. Like, I would like to go to that game. I'd like to see what that's actually going to be like. But, man, like, I don't think you've had a fan base hate a coach quite like this in some times. The closest recent comparison would probably be Lincoln Riley with Oklahoma, but they're not really going to see each other. They haven't run into each other. They kind of barely recruit against each other, but they're certainly not going to play every year, much less going back to where you're playing in the next year, you know, 9 months after you left them. So I think that combined with the way that it ended, the ugliness and sort of Lane looking out for Lane more than Ole Miss, it's going to be something. It's going to be something.
David Ubben of The Athletic and the Bunch Formation podcast has been our guest on D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick. David, before we let you go, any message for your friend Joe Rexroad? He'll be listening.
He still hasn't come around on recognizing that banana pudding is garbage. So other than that,
we'll make sure it gets back to him. David, thank you so much. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you. Appreciate y'all.
Do you feel the same way about banana pudding?
I just don't. I grew up eating banana pudding,
Yeah.
But as an adult, I just don't like the texture. So I've moved away from banana pudding.
My wife loves banana pudding. Mm-hmm. So.
I mean, it was good at one point, but I guess you grow out of things.
Connor, any thoughts on banana pudding?
I adore.
He adores banana pudding.
Oh, wow. That is
all right, Rex Road. Right, the gauntlet has been thrown down by David Ubbin, your colleague at The Athletic. Banana pudding is garbage, he says. I'm not sure I agree. 615-737-1025. We'll take your thoughts on what David Ubbin had to say. And we'll continue the conversation about college football and Nick Saban's testimony yesterday coming up next. 615-737-1025. We are broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service.